This podcast is brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi there, everyone. This is Shane Howard from Goanna. You're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Over 40 years, he's played for prime ministers, Aboriginal elders, and environmental campaigners. From concert halls to protest sites and remote campfires, he's been guest artist for Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Jackson Browne, James Taylor, Carole King, and many others. He is Shane Howard, frontman with the legendary Australian band Goanna. Hi, Shane.
Hi, Gavin. How are you?
Oh, look, I'm fine. It's great to have you on the podcast. Let's talk about your life a little and what a life it's been. You started Goanna all those years ago, and it's still a powerhouse today. You know, the band is still as strong as ever. So congratulations.
Well, thanks, Gavin. It was great to dust off those old songs and rally the team together and go out and do a lap of the country. I think it was interesting this far down the track to revisit all those beautiful old songs.
Well, back then, I mean, Solid Rock, it was the first song to use a didgeridoo. So, you know, you had that passion as a young man.
Certainly the first commercially successful song to use a didgeridoo. I think Ted Egan had a track called Pool Bung and Me back in the late 60s even. And then No Fixed Address were going around that time. So there were instances of that, but of course Solid Rock just hit the airwaves and was overwhelmingly successful commercially and really took Goanna along with it. It was powerful. I didn't think it was Solid Rock was going to be a commercially successful song. I don't think even the record company didn't, but it surprised us all. And of course, you know, the rest they say is history.
It's a beautifully crafted song. Tell me, how did you write that? What was your thought process? And it's a magnificent song when you break it all down. It's like when you look back on it, it's like the perfect song.
It is interesting. In fact, recently I went back out to Uluru for a celebratory event that they were holding out there, the community were holding, and it was televised. And it was great to do that song again. And, you know, when it's become a little bit of the community, the out at Mutitjulu and in the APY lands, they really have taken it to heart as their song. And it was great when we were performing the song towards the end, all the young kids from Mutitjulu just invaded the stage and jumped up and started to shake on stage. It was a very, very beautiful moment, a very overwhelming moment emotionally too. So it really sunk very deeply into the landscape and into the Australian psyche. It's humbling in a way, I guess, Gavin, to think that song saying what it did has reached so far and so wide for so long. And I'm very proud of it. But you're right, that night when we left Uluru, I said to my wife, Therese, I said, pull the car over. And it was dark. The stars were all shining. It was a beautiful night. And I just got out of the car and walked towards the rock. And I really just said, thank you. I think when I was there in 1981 as a young bloke, when I began to write the song and had a great experience, I experienced the local people doing Inma, you know, song and dance ceremony, painted up under the full moon at Uluru, you know, and those very powerful images worked their way into the song. And I just said thank you. I think some things come from you and some things come through you, and that was one of those. I think I was given something, really.
I think more and more people now are becoming aware of Welcome to Country and the smoking ceremony and all of that, and which is a wonderful thing because we are paying homage to our elders and the people that have gone before us. And the rock is that symbol, and that's why In Spirit of Place, the album, which actually has gone platinum 4 times, you know, the rock is there, the plane's flying over it. It's a beautiful image, isn't it?
It really is very powerful, and it came from that experience out there at the time. Mind you, look, as a young bloke, even younger, I'd been hitchhiking up and down the country, and I was only about 19 years of age, and I was writing Razor's Edge, and I had a very strong feeling that I wanted to be a songwriter, that I'd been reading Woody Guthrie's Bound for Glory and Jack Kerouac's On the Road and those things, and I had some crazy bohemian dream about being a musician and a songwriter and trying to make a go of that as a career. When I was 19, I didn't know anything, but I ran into people everywhere I went. Met lots of Aboriginal people, you know, busking in the mall in King George Square in Brisbane and trading country songs back and forward. So I was aware of Aboriginal people and their plight. And the same growing up in southwest Victoria, Aboriginal people were a fact of life, and you didn't have to look very far to understand that they'd got a pretty bad deal, really.
Shane, let's go right back. You said you were in southwest Victoria. Where did you actually grow up?
A little town just outside Warrnambool. You know, I got to travel the country and travel the world and have a good look around. I pretty much ended back where I started, just down the road a bit. But Dad was a factory worker. You know, 48 years of his life, his whole working life was in the Nestlé factory. And, yeah, we grew up by a river in a very rural setting. Big dairy country, spuds and onions, a very kind of very rich Irish, Scottish, well, Celtic region, really. Yeah. So all those things, lots of music, a family that was full of music.
So how many in the family?
There were seven kids. Mum played piano and sang, and was a beautiful pianist and a beautiful singer as well. She'd grown up working on radio in local Warrnambool through IB radio during the war years as well.
Wow.
She'd been in theatre and stuff like that. So Mum gave us the gift of music and Dad gave us a fierce sense of social justice, I guess.
Now, your sister Marcia said that, has been quoted saying that you were the Von Trapp family singers for the region. So everybody sang and played, huh?
That's true. I mean, it was a quote that somebody said. We did lots of community shows and stuff, and it was never for money. Going back that far, and it is a long way back now, the entertainment was mostly live, pre-television. And yeah, so we did lots of community events, sing as a family. And someone wrote up an article one time and said, oh, yeah, the Howard family, the Von Trapps of the Western District. And it kind of stuck, I guess. The Sound of Music was all pervasive at that time, of course.
Well, it was a big movie, wasn't it, back then?
Massive.
We all loved that movie and we all grew up with it. Now, you had to get out of a country town to finish your schooling, uni in Melbourne. How was that for you?
That was great. Imagine being stuck in a country town. I mean, when you're young, I couldn't wait to get out and get to Melbourne, and there was lots going on, you know, and that was an amazing time in, well, probably all around the country, but particularly in Melbourne. Melbourne was such a creative hub. There was so much, there was music in every pub. You know, it was a very experimental time in terms of music, in terms of theatre, in terms of art, all that. Like, and Melbourne was a buzz, really, a very amazing multicultural city. Spent lots of time in Carlton, which was a kind of student Pabio living in those terrace houses, which you could get for $2 a week at that time. We were, I suppose, the inheritors of a couple of things. One, the Gough Whitlam era, which enabled lots of people from working class backgrounds, gave them access to tertiary education. And also the post-war baby boom, which meant that there were so many young people that we were the dominant force.
Yeah, you'd remember It's Time.
I sure do, yeah.
That jingle for Gough Whitlam, that just swept the country, didn't it? Because there was a whole revolution of young people.
There was, and look, the Vietnam War was going. It had fired our imaginations politically. I was coming up for the draft and having to make some really big decisions about would I go to war or not.
Did you get called up?
I didn't. Unfortunately, Whitlam came to power just as my number was due to come up a couple of months before my number was due to come up. So I was greatly relieved.
You were in Carlton, enjoying the uni life, and obviously you thought, let's get a band together. I love the name of your first band. I thought that's a beautiful, beautiful name. Tell me.
It was actually, I'd been at Monash Uni and... Long story short, I mean, I loved that kind of exposure to going to see the Sports and Polacco Brothers, going to see the Dingoes at Greville Street at the Station Hotel, just that explosion of great Australian music that was happening at the time. I then end up travelling around the country and hitchhiking. I ended up back in Geelong at very fledgling, the beginnings of Deakin University. Group of us got together, started playing music, and we were asked to do a concert at Geelong, and we called it the Ectoplasmic Manifestation Concert Band. It's actually a line from a Noel Coward play, Blythe Spirit. So it was trying to be a bit, you know.
You were ahead of your time.
Well, or just being, smart Alex or something. But it was a bit of fun just to take the mickey. And someone actually did a review in the Geelong Advertiser, I think, about that. It was very funny. It grew from that. We kept developing. you know, we brought in a few more players, brought in drums, bass. And, I mean, look, I was kind of a folky at heart in many ways. I'd been, you know, playing acoustic music. I couldn't afford electric instruments. But then we pulled a band together and we knew that if we wanted to get anywhere, you know, to get gigs in the pubs and stuff like that, you had to be rocking. So that was great. There was, you know, four of us, Mike Biskin and Rod Ho and Carl Smith on bass and myself, little four-piece band. And we got a gig at... went and saw the Argyle Hotel in Geelong, and they gave us a residency on Friday night, so I'd know, for about $80. So we thought we were Christmas, thought we'd made it. Geelong was also a really interesting, quite different to Melbourne, a different kind of music scene, but a very healthy music scene at the time. So we were able to get a band up and going, and a few name changes, Gavin, before we finally settled on the Goanna Band.
How did you get the record deal? Tell me about the excitement over that, because you would have been going for, I'd say, a short while, and people obviously saw that you had talent. You're starting to draw crowds. How did that record deal happen?
Well, there's 4 years of torture before we get to that.
Only 4 years?
Oh. Before we're an overnight success, as it is with most bands, you know, there's a lot.
Of course, yeah.
You know, just playing all down the Great Ocean Road and down the coast and, you know, in the Otway forests and playing benefits for the Otways and Torquay surf clubs, all that, Bells Beach, you know, like eventually though we knew we had to go to Melbourne because that's where the action was. And we moved to Melbourne as a band and about 1980. 1981, we kept building a following. And then by 1981, just written Solid Rock, been to Uluru, done that, came back to the band and we worked up the song and we got a great break with Gary Van Egmond. And
what a lovely man.
He was. He was a gentleman promoter, really. Mm. And
one of the good guys.
And our manager, Ian Lovell, went to see Gary and begged him to take on the band to open for James Taylor. Now, incredibly, we had no record. We had no deal with any record company. And Gary agreed and gave us a break on that tour, and we opened for James Taylor on his first national tour of Australia.
So did you get a little scared? Is that why little sister Marcia got in the band and then you got Rose Bygrave? Was that before the James Taylor tour?
That had all happened previously. Like, the four-piece band had fallen apart. We rebuilt the band again, and Rose came into the band, and Warwick Harwood, another guitar player, Robbie Ross on drums, Graham Davidge on guitar. We basically rebuilt the Geelong band in Melbourne. And then Marcia came in right at that time. Ian Lovell, who was managing the band, was very keen for Marcia to be involved in that family harmonies. And interestingly, the sense of these two very strong, very talented and very capable women in the band. So that all happened on the Taylor tour. And for the first time we toured outside Victoria as a band, we travelled to New South Wales with Taylor, played Horton Pavilion, yeah, up to Brisbane, Festival Hall, and across to Festival Hall, the Entertainment Centre in Adelaide. It was a huge break for us. And in Sydney, when we played at the Horden, Warners came along to see the band, a guy called Gibson Kemp. And he, after the show, he came up, he said, I love the band, I want to sign the band. So that was kind of how we got our break and a record deal, really, from that James Taylor tour. So we owe a great debt of gratitude, really, to Gary Van Egmond, who gave us that break.
I didn't know that story, and I'm pleased to hear it, because Gary Van Egmond is just one of the really great promoters in this town.
Hi there, everyone. This is Shane Howard from Goanna. You're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Tobin Brothers believe every life is unique. Every funeral should be too. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Now, you've got the band together, you've got the record deal, and 2 years later, you win Best Debut Single on the Countdown Awards, the Best Debut Album for Spirit of Place, and Best New Talent, Goanna. You picked up three big awards in 1982. What a year.
It was. We just released Spirit of Place and Solid Rock and Razor's Edge and Let the Franklin Flow, which wasn't on the album. That all happened very, very quickly. And then shortly after that, at the Countdown Awards, which were, of course, the forerunner to the ARIA Awards. We won those three awards. It was an incredibly high moment, really, for us as a band. It felt like we had broken through. I mean, the album just went ballistic from day one, and the single. Careful what you wish for, hey, Gavin?
Yeah.
It was amazing to hear Solid Rock blasting out all across the country, you know, on the radio. And, of course, Countdown was a very powerful influence in that regard as an Australian music television show. There was nowhere else where you could have that kind of few. There were a few other kind of small shows, but Countdown every week would turn up. It put Australian bands on a level playing field with international acts. I think an enormous number of Australian artists at that time owe their exposure really at a national level to Countdown, and I would even go so far as to say that Countdown was probably the catalyst for why Australian music was so powerful in the pubs at that time. It gave us an audience because they had seen us on television. It elevated so many bands into the public's imagination. Well, from working class background, we didn't have the wherewithal to do it independently, you know. So that was an amazing time. It was huge profile. We were huge exposure, and off we went into the world of seeing. You know, I met the Americans were then saying the Warners in America were saying, "Drop everything you're doing, come to America. You're going to be bigger than Men at Work."
Well, yeah, you could have ridden that wave.
Well, it was an interesting time. I mean, Men at Work, you know, had just broken through in America in a massive way, and of course they were contemporaries of ours, so it felt like really for the first time it was possible for Australian bands to really break through into the international market, because Australia is a prison island to the tyranny of distance and all that.
So did you follow that through, Shane?
At the time that Warners in America wanted us to drop everything and come there, we hadn't even toured Australia. We hadn't done a national tour of Australia, and we just had all this incredible exposure and success. And we just felt we weren't ready for that at that level. And at one level, I regret it. You go, well, that was an amazing opportunity. But I think we would have had incalculable damage from that kind of success that quickly. And we hadn't even toured Australia. So we stayed, and we felt we owed it to the Australian audience to do that first and get a bit road savvy.
I think that's a good choice, because America is one hell of a place and can chew you up and spit you out very quickly. Not that that mightn't have happened to the band, but mate, you've got Solid Rock. The clip is, you know, 5 million views on YouTube. You know, there's a great audience and an international audience out there that are into the band. Now that we've got you in the band, and now you want to get out of the band and do some solo work, I suppose. When did you get that realisation?
Well, I think it came with the demise of Goanna, a spectacular fall from grace. We went on and did a second album, and some great experiences doing Oceania, you know, working with George Massenberg, the engineer who did all those great Little Feet albums, who were heroes of ours, working in LA with him, the father of Parametric EQ, and working with Billy Payne as a producer, you know, in the studio with Lee Sklar and Billy and that caliber of musician. They were incredible times. Still dealing with Warners in New York and whatever, going to see record companies, you know, Warners in, you know, Germany had been very successful for us, Japan, Canada. But inevitably we got to a point where the second album, it's funny to look back now and go, it wasn't as successful as the first album, which was, you know, ridiculously, astronomically well. The second album, you know, only sold, you know, I don't know, about 50 or 60,000 units. We can only dream of those figures these days. It was a huge investment, that album. We really wanted to make a world album in a way. And we'd funded it ourselves, you know.
Ouch.
Complicated story, long story. But so we then found ourselves on the road trying to pay that off and get ourselves liquid again. The band fell apart. You know, what's James Taylor's line? Dreams and schemes and flying machines in pieces on the ground. So after that, then I left Melbourne. I drifted north. I went to the handback of Uluru to the traditional owners. I felt that was something insignificant. And that was in 85. And then really got invested in a solo career. So by 87, 88, I released the first solo album, again, done independently. And then BMG, a guy called Dick Vercule got in touch with me, and he'd been managing Sunny Boys and Swanee and people like that. He came to see me. I was living in Caranda then, in North Queensland. And he said, look, I think I can get you a deal. So he did, and he went to the fledgling BMG, who were a merger of RCA. And Stuart Rubin and Leon Concannon there. I did the River album then with Mark Moffat, who I'd always had a lot of respect for as a producer and a musician.
Great producer.
Amazing producer and a really incredible musician. What a guitar player. And I loved working with Mark. And in many ways, I think the River album is probably, in many ways, Spirit of Place Part 2. And Mark had a great sensibility of just good, great sounds, noise. And interestingly, of course, he ended up in Nashville and became president of the Americana Association.
Yes, he did, yeah, for many years.
And I've kept in touch with Mark obliquely over the years. But I really love making that record and working with people like Mark Punch and great musicians. Ensemble record that I made in Sydney. And then I made another record with BMG, Time Will Tell, and they're incredibly supportive. And so that really launched me into my solo career. You're forever touring, of course, in the midst of all this too, Gavin. The road goes on forever, yeah?
It does. I feel for all you guys. Well, you've done 14 solo albums, 4 albums with Goanna, and you've produced albums for Archie Roach, the Pilgrim Brothers, Jimmy Chee, and Mary Black. Now, she's interesting. You went to Ireland and opened for her.
Yeah, Mary came to Australia, and Leon Concannon, who was at BMG at the time, had said to me, oh, do you want to do an opening spot for Irishwoman Mary Black? And I knew of Mary, but I knew in her band as well were people like Declan Sinnott, who'd been in a band called Moving Hearts, and they'd played with Van Morrison, and Declan was a great musician. So I said yes, and I did a tour in Australia, and then I got a call. It was Joe. He said, hello, Shane, it's Joe Rook here, Mary's manager, and Mary's had a big hit in Ireland, here in Ireland with your song Flesh and Blood, and we'd love you to come to Ireland and tour with Mary.
What a great opportunity, huh?
It was amazing out of the blue, and then I put a little band together. We went to Ireland. We used Mary's drummer, a guy called Dave Early, who'd played with Van Morrison, Sade, and a lovely man, and beautiful drummer. So that was a really lovely tour we did. Made an album from that tour, that live tour, called Live in Ireland. That really opened the doors for me back into what I would consider to be ancestral country, yeah? So it was a really lovely journey. And look, you know, 10 or more trips since back to Ireland over the years, and it really deepened a connection for me there and for many Irish musicians back here too. So that's been another ongoing journey.
Well, the depth of your songwriting is incredible because a lot of artists have recorded your songs, Joan Baez, Troy Cassar-Daly, Jessica Mulboy. Did you see her at the Pride opening up in Sydney?
I didn't see her on that, but she certainly is an incredible voice. And I saw her do a version of Solid Rock on television one time, and it just blew me away, power of her performance.
Missy Higgins has also recorded some songs, and John Farnham, you know, and you've also along the way, Shane, picked up some great awards through your musical journey, a fellowship by the Australian Council for the Arts, Australian Representative 2000 in the North American Folk Alliance, Life Member of the Australian Folk Alliance, Artist of the Year at the Port Ferry Folk Festival. Now, there's a great quote, I love this, from the festival director, Jamie McHugh. He said, Shane Howard bridges the land between poet and songwriter, between prophet and singer, and between white fellas and Indigenous artists. I think that sums you up beautifully.
Very generous of Jamie, indeed. It's an incredible journey, Gavin, for a kid from a little country town in southwest Victoria. So I feel very, very privileged. An ongoing relationship with Aboriginal Australia that has so deeply enriched my life. And then, like I was saying, then having the opportunity to go back and reconnect with, you know, Ireland and that kind of deep part of, you know, my ancestral heritage. And at the heart of it all is are the songs and the music. And that journey never ends. It's the songs keep coming. I don't know where they come from, but they keep coming. And I am their servant.
Well, it's the dream time. Put it down to that. 2016, congratulations. You were appointed a member of the Order of Australia. Services to the performing arts as a singer, guitarist, and to Indigenous musicians. That must have been a very, very proud moment for you and your family, being the first one in the family to get an AM.
Again, an embarrassment of riches. It was very humbling. to be recognised, you know, nationally like that. I was ambiguous about it at the time, I got to say, Gavin, because I felt that the way we treated Aboriginal people in this country left a lot to be desired. And but look, if it can help to give you a voice and to help others, then that's a good thing. But look, everything honours, you know, those who come before you.
Mm. 2018, Solid Rock was identified by the National Film and Sound Archive in Australia as one of the essential sounds that helped define Australian history and culture. Now, that is a big one.
Yeah, I'm a bit overwhelmed as you're reciting all these things off.
Well, you've done well, man. Congratulations. It's a fine achievement. You know, be proud of this because you worked hard for it.
It is lovely to be honoured and recognised by your contemporaries and by your country. Music is like the horizon, you know. You keep walking toward it, but you never get there. There's always the next song, the next challenge out in front of you, and you just got to keep working and walking towards the great song is yet to be written in many ways.
Like all songwriters, the next one is usually the best one.
Hi there, everyone. This is Shane Howard from Goanna. You're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Any song can be played at a funeral. What would you like? Visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Now, after the Big 30 concert tour last year, you were also made ambassador for Children's Ground, working to make real and lasting change for First Nations people. I mean, there's a lot of work there for you.
Great organisation, Children's Ground, based ostensibly out of Alice Springs, but it's a really interesting model. It basically works with Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal people themselves design the educative model, which is about two-way learning, keeping their own culture and language strong, but learning in that Western way too through our, you know, education system. So that double process of empowerment, maintaining your identity and integrity, but also, you know, learning how to be doctors, how to be lawyers, how to be in the modern world and still retain that very deep, strong sense of identity and culture.
That is so important, yes.
Yeah.
Now, The Voice, your thoughts.
My take on that, I guess, is what possible good could come from a no vote? You know, it's not everything. In fact, it's not a lot. Should Aboriginal people have a voice? Of course they should. Do they have a voice? Not really in a legislative sense. They're not even written into the Constitution. Lots of people say, you know, which is a terrible, this is unfinished business, are arguing about how will it work and what will it look like. And really the what and the how are for legislators and for lawyers and for politicians to work out. The why is what's important for us as Australian, as the Australian population. Why should they have a voice? Because they haven't had one. A little example recently we had on January the 26th, I was asked by the local council if I could, by the mayor, if she wanted to engage the local Indigenous community on the 26th of January in some meaningful way. I said, that's not easy. So I spoke to some of the local community and they agreed to a process of what Port Fairy has down here in southwest Victoria. There's a monument to all those who fell in the frontier wars and a lot of the massacres that happened. Southwest Victoria is one of the highest concentration of colonial massacre sites in the country. It was a brutal colonial process. So how we began the day was almost like Anzac Day in a way. At that monument, there was a smoking ceremony and a beautiful cultural ceremony took place, and then a senior local person, Uncle Rob Lowe, spoke about those difficult times for Aboriginal people in that country and paid respects to them. We expected 50, 60, 70 people to come. There were nearly 300 people there. And it shows that Australians are moving on, the next generation, and, you know, even the older ones are moving on. We want this to be right. We want this sorted out. It's 40 years since Solid Rock. We want to have this relationship with our First Nations people right. 65,000 years of continuous culture, the oldest continuous culture on earth, and the oldest spirituality on earth, as like as Mungo Man and Mungo Lady remind us, buried in 42,000 years ago out there at Lake Mungo with red ochre and fire and ceremony. This is the oldest evidence we have of human beings behaving in a ritualistic, spiritual and ceremonial way. There's nothing to lose and everything to gain from getting this relationship really right. So should Aboriginal people have a voice, Gavin? Absolutely.
And I believe that too. And I think Solid Rock should be the theme song for the voice.
Really, Gavin.
I think that's the anthem, because when you look at the lyrics, it says it all. And how were you to know when you wrote that song all those years ago that it would be even more relevant today?
I couldn't have known that then. I like Let the Franklin Flow, I thought they were contemporary issues that might get dealt with and songs that might blow away in the wind. But I was wrong about that. I'd like to think in a way that it becomes a piece of history, that song, and is no longer relevant in terms of the struggle for Aboriginal people. And my journey, Gavin, has taken me so deeply into Aboriginal Australia that these are my friends, these are my brothers and sisters. I can't stand by and see that hurt and that disempowerment. To see Aboriginal people at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder in a land that was once theirs, that we, prosperity we enjoy in this country comes on the back of immense suffering for Aboriginal people. We've got to do better. We can do better. We want to do better. And we need our political masters to reflect the change that we need in this country.
Beautifully said. I love the phrase, welcome to country. I think it makes everybody aware that we do have a beautiful country. The voice has got to move forward with a yes, and I'm with you there. Keep up the good work. Now, I forgot to ask you a question when you were talking about Goanna and your success in Melbourne. Did you know that everybody wanted to stay at the Goanna Manor? I mean, what a place that was. A great looking house in St Kilda, wasn't it? It was one of those heritage homes.
It was a beautiful old place. Amazing old building. The crew had their own production room. There was an art room. There was a screen printing area out in the sheds out the back. We had our own publishing office, management office.
It was a one-stop shop.
We weren't quite a Paris commune, but lots of people, I think, thought we were a commune. We're all living there, but of course we weren't.
So there was some kind of formality to it, was there? So you didn't wake up in the morning and go, who are those three guys over there sleeping in the corner?
I think the mythology was greater than the reality, but it was amazing. Lots of people came there, visited there, wanted to see what was going on. I remember someone in the music industry saying to us at the time, stop thinking you're different. You know, you're just the same as... But we were different. We were mad. We were completely energized by what we were doing. We had big plans, big dreams. We printed our own posters. We went out at night in the middle of the night and put them up on the city walls. And I guess because we came out of Geelong, we had a kind of otherness about really wanting to make a go of it in Melbourne and beyond.
I think there was a lot of jealousy, Shane. I think everybody wanted to go out of Manor.
Making money was not our motivation.
And that's the beautiful part about it, isn't it?
Well, we all wanted to make a living, but we wanted to do something really... We had a fierce determination, inspired by people like the Dingoes and Richard Clapton and that amazing Goodbye Tiger album. Those sorts of Australian artists, Daddy Cool, and we wanted to make a distinctively Australian sound, and we wanted to make distinctively Australian music. And we wanted our art to reflect that, and so, yeah, we were postmodern romantics.
You were ahead of your time. That's what you were. To have a one-stop shop like that.
Yeah, and not great relationships. You know, at the same time, no fixed address was starting to emerge in Melbourne. There's that first great wave of Aboriginal artists was starting to emerge. Now they were followed by, you know, bands like, Rumpy Band, and then, came Archie Roach, and then came you got the indie, and that whole emergence of Aboriginal music and Aboriginal people being able to tell their story with their own voice too.
Now, you're currently working on your autobiography. Will the Goanna Manor get a mention in that?
Absolutely. In fact, I probably don't need to release that book anymore. I think I've told you everything now.
How's it going? Have you nearly finished it?
I have. There are too many words, and what I'm in the middle of editing now and cutting it down. It needs to be a third of the size that it is, really, or no one be able to hold the book. I started down this journey nearly 15 years ago, but I've just never had the time to really edit and commit to finishing it, but I'm determined to do it.
Good on you. Now, I'm going to do the top 10 right now, as we did on Countdown. 10 questions without notice. Have you got time?
Yep.
All right, first question. Who inspired you to make music?
To be a songwriter? Bob Dylan.
Question two. What have you learnt over your musical journey?
Serve the songs.
Just explain that a bit for me.
Don't let your ego get in the way. Serve the music.
Okay. Question three. What was the effect of Countdown on your career?
I would say elevation. It gave us a national audience and propelled Goanna into the public spotlight.
Now, if you could open up a show, be it Goanna or Shane Howard as a solo act, who would it be? Who would you like to open up a show for?
If I could open up a show, the Beatles.
Oh, yes. You'd be drowned out with the scream still. They wouldn't hear you, Shane. All right, let's move on to question five. Name three dinner guests, dead or alive.
Three dinner guests, dead or alive. Kurt Vonnegut, the writer, who famously said, "For God's sake, don't waste your life. Go and be an artist." The other one would be Martin Luther King.
Wow, yes.
And Bob Dylan.
Ooh, yeah. I'd like to be a fly on the wall on that dinner. What's your favourite song to perform?
Favourite song to perform? Well, the next song.
Spoken by a true songwriter. Question seven, what's the most trouble you've ever gotten into? I don't think Shane Howard has ever gotten into trouble. I don't think you're a bad, bad guy.
I have gotten into trouble over the years. Yeah, I got arrested in Alice Springs by the police.
Stop it, did you? What were you doing?
I'd had a few drinks and I was being very rowdy in the mall in Alice Springs. The police came and arrested me. I was a bit drunk and disorderly. And fortunately, as irony would have it, I was rescued by Bart Willoughby and my Aboriginal friends.
Fantastic. How old were you then?
This was...
last week?
No. It was just after the hand back of Uluru.
Oh, okay.
To the traditional owners, yeah, 85.
Oh, so you're on a high.
I was wildly angry. Yeah, and wildly angry and alcohol, not a good combination.
No, very true. Now, if you could change anything about the music industry, what would you do?
Okay, in this era, if I could change anything about the music industry, I would make promoters and record companies have to be more reliant on supporting Australian artists.
Yeah, they've got to get back to that. They've got to get A&R guys back, I think.
Yeah, it's difficult now in a digital world, but I think it's too easy. It's not a level playing field. America has a population 12 times the size of Australia's. So if you're a fringe artist, in America, you have 12 times as many sales, 12 times as many people in your audience. They have a much greater return. They have the capacity to have much more powerful promotion and marketing. It's very still difficult for Australian artists to get beyond our shores.
Now, Shane Howard, what's the best show that you've ever done?
The one that springs to mind is when we opened for James Taylor in Adelaide at the Festival Theatre. It was the last show of the tour, and I'll never forget that night. We performed Solid Rock, and we were just the opening act, and we got a standing ovation at the end.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And that was amazing. We were just an opening act, and it was an amazing moment. We finished with Solid Rock, and there was a standing ovation. Billy Cummins was with us, Murray fellow, Aboriginal fellow from Queensland, playing Didge. It was at that moment I think we felt that maybe there was something special going on.
Obviously, yes. Now, Shane, last question in the top 10. What have you learnt and what would you pass on to a young, hopeful musician?
If you really want to play music or you really want to be a songwriter or you want to be a musician or an artist, you need to do it like you breathe air, then go and do it. Other than that, go and get a real job.
Just like your parents told you all those years. Why don't you get a real job?
Pretty much, yeah.
You, sir, are a respected senior statesman in Australia who continues to work as a poet, musician, writer, singer, producer and mentor. And I am so proud to be a mate of yours, Shane. Keep up the great work. Love what you're doing. Just keep the fight going.
On you, Gavin. Go well. And, look forward to catching up one of these days.
Good on you, buddy. I appreciate your time. All the very best, buddy.
This podcast brought to you thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives every day of the year.